Hello, I'm Lindsay.
And this is Candace.
Oh, and this is our lady parts.
See, you already were going to forget.
Jeez.
And we're not talking about our vaginas, guys.
Not today. But we do have a special guest on today. Her name is Emma. And I met Emma, maybe like 9 or 8 years ago. In college, she was an advisor sort of to me, and she's my sorority sister. And I could just go on and on about how, Emma, you have impacted my life in more ways than you'll ever know.
Lindsay's already going to start crying.
I'm not going to cry now. I cry all the time. It's ridiculous.
I know.
But so, Emma, if you'll just take us through and introduce yourself, and then after that, I'm going to explain to them why we have you on today.
Okay, sounds good. Yeah, so Lindsay, I guess you were 2009, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah, so we've known each other for going on 11 years.
Oh, God.
That's a long time.
I'm so old.
I know.
You're in your last years of your 20s.
I know.
Lindsay had a birthday, guys. Happy birthday to Lindsay. We should mention that.
Happy birthday.
She's in her last year of her 20s.
Yeah, well, let me tell you, the 30s are awesome. You're going to really enjoy it.
Oh, I'm excited.
To worry about.
I'm excited about turning 30.
I'm excited about turning 30. I feel like I'll be, people will take me credibly.
Yeah, for sure.
Does that make sense?
Yes,
I know. I think a lot of people, because I'll be 34 this year, and a lot of people are like, how old are you? And I'm like, 33. And I get this a lot at work, and they're like, oh, I thought you were like 25. So I think people still kind of underestimate, you know, how old you are. And then when you tell them, they're more shocked than anything else. So that's always fun.
You just burst my bubble. That's like my whole life. I'm just waiting to be older so people take me seriously. Just pop that one.
All right. Sorry, Emma. We totally messed you up.
No, you're fine. I am a mental health therapist during the day. I am a master's level therapist, so just a little education piece for people that are listening. People don't really understand like how therapy kind of works, and a lot of people think that you have to go to a psychologist or a psychiatrist to go to therapy, and that's not the case. So you have master's level counselors. And these are a lot of people that are in private practice or might work at hospitals or in community mental health settings. And so that's what I do. So I'm a master's level clinician. I'm a licensed professional counselor with my mental health service provider designation, which is specific to the state of Tennessee. I work with people with all ages, of all ages. I have had experience. I worked with Jerry Psych for a while in a group setting. I've worked in an inpatient psychiatric hospital where we did with acute detox and psychosis. So this is people coming right in from jail or the emergency room or on their way to jail or before they go to rehab. And we would do a medical detox if it was drugs that was the issue, or if there was severe psychosis issues and they were not medicated, then we would medicate them to baseline and then send them on to a group home or a residential treatment facility or something like that. I'm in private practice, so I'm my own boss, which is really nice, and I get to make my own rules, which is really fun, and I work with, I see people of all ages, so the youngest clients that I see are 5, and the oldest client I've ever worked with was 93.
Wow.
So, wow.
Yeah. Yes. So I do mostly individual counseling. I do family sessions sometimes with, like, established clients, especially with my teenagers. I have a lot of teenagers right now, a lot of middle schoolers. So a lot of times in those settings, we're working on issues at home with communication or behavior. And so we'll bring families in to do family sessions. I don't do any couples counseling. it's just not my jam.
Yeah.
That's a whole nother level of training that I don't have and I'm not seeking at this time. So mostly just individual. And I really like to specialize in working with people with anxiety and more lifestyle type of issues. So I do a lot of mindfulness-based therapy. I do work with depression, anxiety, OCD, bipolar disorder. I work with a lot of teenagers around like transitional times. And then I do a lot of wellness work with people. So how to be healthy. I do a lot of psychoed about, you know, general health and well-being, like why you need to sleep and why you need to eat healthier foods and nutrition and how that affects our mental health.
You mean I can't just drink coffee and not sleep?
No, you can't. You can for a short amount of time. I've done it. But, you know, I work with a lot, and I like to bring in a lot of those types of interventions into the counseling process because it's something very tangible for people to like grab onto that they can do immediately. So kind of looking at some diet stuff, looking at like how much is your caffeine intake? Are you smoking? Are you drinking a lot of alcohol? Are you not sleeping? Are you not getting enough deep sleep or REM sleep? So I do a lot of that type of integrative mental health as well. So I really am kind of all over the place. But my main goal working with people is just to figure out what they need and then try to meet them there. And so whatever resources that means, that's what we try to bring into it. So it's fun.
Oh, it sounds extremely interesting.
It sounds extremely interesting, and she basically just described my life. Like, I feel like I need to drink way less caffeine. I need more sleep. Like,
I think you put a realistic approach to what you do, though, because how many times have you been in a conversation with people, and they're like, oh, I could be a therapist. I should be a therapist. I love listening to people, and I'm like, there's way more to it.
Yeah. I could probably be a CIA agent before I could be a therapist.
I could do neither.
I could find... I found out Will's traffic ticket from Virginia, and I had no idea even the county, and I figured it out today within like 5 minutes. So
nice.
Oh, it's stalking
a C. Yeah, I mean, I think that it's difficult work, but it's difficult in different ways than most people would think. Like one of the things that I was talking to one of my colleagues about the other day. You know, when we talk about like work and our capacity to work, they say and studies show that people really only can focus like 3 to 4 hours of the day. That's about all of the active work time you're going to get out of somebody.
I've heard that too.
But when you're, and so, you know, if you're in an office setting, you know, there's a lot of that time that's like going to get a water or a coffee or going to the bathroom or, you know, cruising Facebook or whatever. And not everybody's job is like that, but there's more space for that. But when you are a counselor, you know, I have to be just as good for my 9 a.m. client as I am for my 4:15 client.
Yeah.
Which means I have to be on all the time.
Which I think is that leads into like my biggest question for you, which you don't have to answer right now because I'm sure you'll touch base on it multiple times throughout our whole conversation. But my biggest thing is when I think of therapists and counselors and stuff is how do they deal with their own issues when they've had the background of that education. They by the book, they know how to deal with it, but how does that play out in their real life? And how do they cope with listening to other people's issues on top of their own? Like how much is too much? It's like you have your own issues and you're basically taking everybody else's issues and feeding that to your energy. And how does that just not bring you down and make you have even more issues? So,
yeah, I think that's it's a really good and it's a very complex question because there's so many pieces that go into that. And I think for people, you know, at the baseline of it, I think it really comes down to like self-awareness, boundaries, and understanding the ins and outs of empathy. So a lot of people that are good therapists, and I don't, maybe I shouldn't say that, but from my experience, a lot of people that are good therapists are naturally very empathic, but empathy without boundaries gets very dangerous because you are taking on things that aren't yours. And so a huge part of the process of learning how to become a therapist, so first off, we have so much oversight, you guys, it's crazy. Most people don't understand that a master's level therapist, I went to graduate school for 4 years, and then I had a minimum of 2 years after graduate school before I could even get a license, before I could ever get credentialed with insurance or anything. That's 6 years that it took me to get a license, which is the same amount of time that you would be like a doctor.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of training and oversight that goes into that. And a huge part of that training needs to be like, how do you set boundaries with your clients and with yourself? How do you know when too much is enough for you? And how do you know when there's countertransference or transference in a counseling setting? And so that's where like somebody might walk in and they've had the same situation that I've had and it's not resolved for me. and ethically I need to know that in that moment, and then I need to not work with that person. And so that it gets really complex in that, and how do you know that and then deal with, you know, what that looks like in a realistic setting to sit across from somebody that probably worked through so many steps to get to your office,
and you then can't for you
to them. Have to tell them, yeah, like, I can't, like, this is not going to be an ethical fit for me. And that's extremely difficult to do. And so that requires, you know, for a lot of us that ethically that we're working on our own stuff too on the background, and that we've resolved these issues, and that we understand our own limitations and boundaries, and we can verbalize that and model that to our clients. So it's very complex, like, interplay, because you're talking about people to people directly, you know. Yeah. And when we're in session, for me at least, like, some therapists take notes. Some people do other things. I don't. Like, I can't write and listen to you at the same time. I just know that. I get way too distracted. And so it is just me and this person in a room looking at each other and having these very vulnerable conversations. And that gets a little intense at times. So,
yeah, so with you saying that, I have two questions for you. Is the first one is, how often do you turn away clients?
I'm trying to think if I've ever actually come across that in my own practice. And I don't think that I have ever personally had to do that. And part of that is because I really encourage, like, where I work, we have a front office staff. And so they know, some of the issues that I maybe am not comfortable working with or not within my scope of practice. And so there have been times where I've been in session with somebody and they're like, hey, I have this issue. And I'm like, okay, cool. That's not within my scope of practice. I'm not trained to deal with that. So, like, somebody with a severe eating disorder, I'm not trained to deal with that. And so in that situation, you can refer out, and that's a little bit easier because it's not about,
it's not like
you,
breaking right? up. It's basically not breaking up, but just like adding another person into the relationship.
Absolutely. Okay. This is not within my scope of practice. Let's get you set up with somebody that can really help
that
you
makes
with
things
this, because I don't want to be unethical.
Yeah.
But I've not run into the situation yet where I've had somebody that I couldn't work with because of a transference or a counter-transference issue. But it does happen, and I've experienced it alongside of some of my colleagues. And a couple of situations have come up where people have walked out of session and been like, I need you to step in to my office. I need you to take over this intake for me. And then we're going to transfer them right to you right now in this moment, because it's an issue that is currently going on in my life, or something that I can't, it is rare, and it happens, but it's not something that we're seeing at times. So that's a really positive thing.
Okay. So my next question is kind of ridiculous. I know it's going to be absolutely ridiculous asking this, but I think of, like, when I think of stuff like this, like, I just think of, like, movies and, like, things that happen that are fictional. I'm curious if this ever happens in real life. You're having those vulnerable conversations with people and, like, getting attached to them. Do you ever have, like, patients that, like, fall in love with you or, like, are become obsessed with you?
I just knew this was coming out of your mouth.
Like, I just, like, do people, like, obsess? Because, like, you're building a relationship with them. Like, maybe you aren't, like, attaching to them, but they're attaching themselves to you. So, like, do you ever have, like, a crazy one or... that's mean to say crazy, but I mean, like over the edge, like, patient who just kind of comes obsessed with you.
If they have been in love with me, it's not something they've told me. So okay. I haven't. Nobody has ever been like, oh my God, Emma, I love you. And I think part of it is, like, in counseling, you know, a lot of my job is to be obviously present with them, and we are building a relationship, but to do that with very strict boundaries and to reiterate those boundaries a lot. I think one of the bigger issues that we run into, and that absolutely does happen. I mean, in the ACA, which is the American Counseling Association's code of ethics, they actually have a whole ethical code as to when it is appropriate to have sexual relations with a client.
Oh my God.
Like, honestly, that has to be there because I'm sure it happens.
So stop giving me that look, Lindsay, asking that question.
No, it happens all of the time. And it happens so much that the ACA actually changed the ethical code, I believe, in the last iteration of the code. So it used to be it was never appropriate to have a sexual relationship with a client. Now it's that you have to wait 5 years after they are our client before you can have a sexual relationship with them, because it's a constant issue. Wow. Because when we're in a counseling setting, it feels like intimacy, right? It feels like this is a person that's listening to me and cares about me, and that can really mimic like love or affection. And it, you might have love and appreciation for that person for providing you that space, but it's not love and affection, right? It's not building a mutual relationship. It is extremely one-sided. My clients know very little about me. They don't share things about my life. I don't talk to them about my experiences. That's just not a part of it.
Yeah.
So for them, I am just this person that listens really well and can reflect back what they're saying. And so, but it absolutely happens all of the time. The bigger issue that we run into, and I think maybe this is just cultural because we're in the South, is like gift giving. So like around holidays and stuff like that, I'll have my clients like bring me presents, and that is so sweet. And I completely get it. Like culturally in the South, that's just what we do, right? We make food for people. We bring them gifts.
Yeah. I totally
very warm and welcoming.
I totally gave my daughter's speech therapist a gift after she graduated speech therapy as a thank you gift.
I give Christmas cards. Does that count as a gift?
Yeah, it does.
And the problem with that is that we are ethically not allowed to accept gifts because it is seen as an inappropriate exchange within a counseling relationship. So that's always really hard when somebody brings you a gift. And this always happens at Christmas. Every single year it happens at Christmas. There'll be a client who's like, curated a gift for me. That's really sweet. And they bring it to me and I'm like, oh gosh, thank you so much. I really appreciate this, but I can't take this from you. And that's a very difficult conversation to have because I know that they weren't doing it maliciously.
Yeah, they're doing it with good intentions.
Yeah, they're trying to be nice.
Absolutely. And, you know, maybe I've bent the rules a little bit. There have been some gifts, like I had a client make me this really beautiful wreath one time. She had gotten into wreath making. She was in sobriety and this was like her thing. And so she made me a wreath and I thought it was so cool. And so I just kept it at the office. Like we just hang it up in the office, you know?
Yeah, I think that's fine.
But it's like when people bring expensive gifts or
like gift cards when they don't and stuff like that.
Yeah, respect that boundary and stuff. That's where it gets a little sticky. So anything that's like food related and stuff like that, if clients bring us, like we have a couple of clients that are always bringing like donuts and bread to our office and stuff, and like we're like, please stop for multiple reasons. We're all getting fat, but like also please stop. You know, we can't accept these things. So there's just a lot of nuances to it, to that relationship that are kind of weird. And difficult to navigate, but absolutely not impossible to navigate.
Do you have any more questions for her?
No, I'm sorry.
You're so funny. Okay.
You can go on with your story.
Actually, that was extremely enlightening. And I mean, those are questions I never would have asked you, but I'm so glad Candace did.
Oh, yeah, right. Lindsay was like, wanted to like cover her face with a pillow. She was like, oh,
no,
God.
It was good. It was good. But we brought Emma on today to talk a little bit about her personal story and her personal journey. Emma, I'm going to let you take it, but just a little introduction is Emma lost her mom a long time ago, and I'm going to give no specifics here. And so she's going to walk us through this story. She's going to talk about how now knowing everything she knows about doing what she does as a career. Walk us through her anxiety, her trauma, and then we're going to end the conversation a little bit with where she's at now in her life. And I just think that this is an interesting story, especially coming after we talked about Candace losing her brother a few weeks ago. So
Last week. Oh, well, this will be in a couple of weeks. So, yeah, in a couple of weeks ago.
A few, yeah.
Sorry, Lindsay.
No, you're fine. But Emma, I'll let you take it
from
here.
Okay, but see, was that not the creepiest thing ever, Lindsay, that just happened?
I know. So Candace's computer just came on right after I mentioned her brother, and we think...
So last time we mentioned him...
Yeah, he did it.
It did it too.
We think he may be haunting her. Specifically her computer.
Specifically my computer.
He just
wants
to play games.
Yeah.
Wow. I get that. I think sometimes like serendipitous things happen and you're like, what was that? You know, I'm always like,
Lindsay's kind of freaked out right now.
Not she's fair.
Like, I believe in ghosts.
Yeah. Lindsay's like, Candace, your brother's hanging out with us.
He's pretty cool, Ghost. So. I know.
Okay, sorry. Go ahead, Emma.
No, you're good. Yeah. Yeah, so I did. I listened to all of y'all's episodes up until now. I'm curious. I listened to the episode about your brother, and I think there's a lot of parallels that we probably share in our experiences, but I also really thought it was so cool how you talked about it in a way that was very direct, and you were very honest about how you felt about it, but also you were so good about like setting boundaries, and I think people really struggle with that in grief. Like, how do I set boundaries with people? How do I tell people, like, don't call me and ask me how I'm doing?
Yeah, so that's a new thing. That's a new thing this year, because in the past few years when that has happened, I think I realized this year that I just needed to be honest with people, because the other past 3 years and stuff that it's happened where people reach out, it just brings me down even more. It almost irritates me. Like, that's the only thing I can explain it. Like, it irritates me and annoys me when people do, because that's the only time. My biggest thing is I'll post something on Facebook about it, and that's when someone reaches out. And it's like, if you're not going to reach out on a random Monday just being like, hey, what's up? How are you feeling? Like, how's grief going? Yeah. Then I don't want you to reach out to me on February 11th every year after I make a post on Facebook. Like, that's my thing.
Absolutely.
But yeah.
And I think that just really speaks to like how individualized the grief experience is for everybody, because some people might be the exact opposite. And it's all about like knowing where you're at and being able to set those boundaries and understanding that that is a really important part of the process. So my husband just walked in and he's like staring at me, and now he's trying to cover his mouth. but my dog didn't bark, so we're all good. Woo! So I've been thinking a lot about how to kind of tell this story to a bunch of people that have no like understanding of who I am or why I would be telling this story. And so I think that it's really important for me, in order to tell my story, to give a little bit of background information about my mom's story, because that's really integral into her life and then eventually her suicide. And she died 14 years ago. It'll be 15 years this November 23rd. So feel free to interject if you guys have.
No, you're fine. We will.
I'm a really good listener.
Yeah, we're good at listening, but okay. I'm sure that one of us will interject with a question.
Yeah.
Okay, awesome. So my mom was born in Washington State in a town. She was born in Walla Walla, Washington, which is a real place. People think it's not a real place, but it is a real place. And they're like, that's a silly place, but it's real. So she was born in Walla Walla, Washington in 1960, and then eventually her family migrated to Central Illinois, like right outside of Champaign-Urbana.
Interesting, and, that's where I'm from.
Yeah, so she was from Saybrook. Are you familiar with that?
Well, you said Central Illinois. Like I'm more Southern Illinois, but I am familiar with like more of the Springfield, Champaign area, but I don't know like surrounding towns and stuff.
Well, there's like 12 people there, and I think I'm related to all of them. Yeah. So you would miss it. Like, there's not even a gap.
Welcome to Illinois.
Yes, lots of corn. Yes. So she grew up in Illinois, and my mom was the youngest of five, and so she was always kind of the baby of the family. But my mom grew up in a family that had a lot of trauma, a lot. Her father, who I never met, I don't even know his name, her biological father, he was extremely abusive. Like the kind of stuff that you see on like Lifetime movies that you think like this can't be real, but he was extremely sexually abusive to her two older sisters. He was very physically abusive with her brothers and with her mother. But my mom was always spared from that abuse because she was kind of like the baby of the family. And she was his favorite, as she kind of put it. And so while she witnessed this abuse, he never directed it towards her. This is what she grew up in until she was probably about 14. And I've heard the story so many times from her, but basically my biological grandfather, he like threatened to kill my grandmother, and he was holding a knife up to her throat and was saying he was going to stab her and like kill all the kids, and just like completely lost his mind. And my grandma was able to get away from him in that moment, and she grabbed the kids and they ran out the door. My mom said that her sisters were already in the yard, I think, at this point in time. And they all jumped in the car and left, and she never saw him again after that. So my grandmother got a lot of help. I think she went to like one of those like battered women shelters and got some assistance from people. She ended up meeting my grandfather, who I've always known. His name's Tom. He was a UPS worker, the sweetest man you'll ever meet in your whole life. She met him. She remarried when my mom was 14. And then my mom grew up with Tom as her stepfather. So when my mom was, I think, like 17 or 18, she moved to Indiana in Evansville and then met my dad not too long after that. So she had come from this very abusive childhood. This was her whole normal. She moved out on her own and was living in Evansville, and she met my dad, and my parents met in a library. So it's a really like cute story. My mom was, my dad said she was like in the library and she was looking up books on astrology, and my dad thought she was really pretty. And my dad at the time worked with his brother at PBS in Evansville. So he had on the PBS jacket, and my mom thought he like worked at a TV station and was famous. And so she kept giving him the eyes, you know? And she said that every time she would look up, my dad was like one seat closer to her, until eventually she looked up and he was at the same table as her. And that's how they met. That's in like cute. The early 80s. So very cute. Very meet cute, I think, as they say.
Pre-Tinder.
So, yes, pre-Tinder. There was no Tinder yet. Yeah. So my parents met and they got married and they like had an apartment and they're doing all this stuff. My mom never graduated from high school, and so my dad helped her get her GED. And so she got her GED, and then I came along. I was a big surprise. I don't think that they had ever planned to have kids. My dad was 32 when I was born. And like to this day, I always ask him, I'm like, you didn't really plan to have kids, did you? And he's like, you are such a blessing. You're always planning. I was like, yeah, but like, you didn't really plan to have kids, did you? So he's never acknowledged that, but I think that it's very true. So I came along, I was born in 86, and everything was good. Like, my mom was extremely doting on me and my younger sister. She was very caring and kind and very gentle. She was an extremely sensitive person. If you're familiar with like the Enneagrams, I would assume she's probably a strong two, very people pleasing. She just really wanted the like people around her to be happy and just feel comfortable, you know, just have a good place to be. She liked to create a space for people. And so my whole childhood, like, people were always at my house. And I'm not talking like three or four people. I'm talking like 12 people at a time at my house. I would have these huge sleepovers every year for my birthday. It's in October. I would have these massive Halloween parties, and she would go all out. Like, I remember in the second grade, she spent like a week making all of these like tombstones and putting them in our yard. And she was like a gypsy, and she got one of those old like overhead light covers with like a globe and like put a candle in it. She's like reading everybody's fortunes. Like, she just was such a doting, fun person. She went when I was little. We moved from Indiana to Oregon and then eventually to Tennessee. And when we lived in Oregon, she got her degree in respiratory therapy. So she worked in the ER, and we ended up in Knoxville, Tennessee, because she wanted to work on helicopters and do like life flight emergency medicine. So they were one of the only programs that trained for that, and that's how she ended up in Knoxville. So everything was like pretty good, but there was also, you know, there's always a shadow side to things. And the shadow side of this was that my mom was also a really big alcoholic. It would go through phases. Like, there would be times where everything was fine, and she was probably more on the binge drinking side of things. It wasn't an everyday thing, but when she would binge, it was days at a time that she would be completely incapacitated. My parents separated for a while, and they got back together. They fought a lot. My mom and dad are both wonderful people. They were just not good together. You know, they just couldn't ever really get on the same page. And my dad kind of talks about it now. Like, he always felt like he was parenting my mom in a lot of ways, because she was like 6 years younger than him, but she also had so much trauma from her past that she didn't really know how to be her own independent person. So, you know, while there were all these really great, wonderful things going on, there was also these really negative and traumatizing things going on. And I think that's how it is for a lot of people. And, you know, nobody's good or bad, but for my mom, she was such a wonderful person, and she just had this uncontrollable thing that she couldn't face, and she couldn't do anything about. So, or she felt like she couldn't do anything about. It wasn't until after she died that I really got the full picture of what was going on for her. She was also diagnosed bipolar disorder 1. So there's 2 types of bipolar, 1 and then 2. The first one is really severe, and the second one is less severe. So it's the same process. Like, you're swinging from mania to depression, but it's just when you're bipolar 1, it can be a much more violent swing. And so when she was manic, this is when we would say, like, mom, my sister and I used to say mom's in one of her moods. And so there were classic signs that this was happening. She wouldn't sleep. She would have music on really, really, really loud. She would have friends over. She would cook a lot. She would cook a lot of food, and she would make us invite our friends over. She would want to go do stuff, like crazy stuff. Like, she would be like, let's go join this church. She would go through these religious manic phases where we would just join all of these different churches, and we would stay at them for a couple of weeks, and we would be there every time the doors would open. And then we would never go back. And then she would be depressed, and she would drink, and she would binge when she was depressed. And, you know, mom was kind of incapacitated. And then she'd be manic again. And then it would be super fun, right? Because when people are manic, they're in a great mood all of the time. And so everything would be so fun. We'd go do all this fun stuff. We'd go to the movies. We'd spend all of our money. It was just constantly back and forth. And as a kid, I didn't really know what was going on. I just knew mom's in one of her moods or she's not, right? And there were very few times where everything was kind of leveled out. And so my parents divorced when I was 13. And it was one of those situations where I very vividly remember my mom telling me, like, she picked me up from school. I was in middle school, and we got in the car, and she pulled over and she's like, I need to tell you something. And I was like, okay, what's up? And she's like, your dad and I are getting divorced. And I just looked at her and I was like, good, finally. Because it was so bad at home at times. They're just, yeah.
I've had that. I've had kind of a similar situation happen to me. So I get that.
Yeah. Yeah. I was very much like what we would call now parentified, in the sense of because I was the older sister. So I took on a lot of roles as a child. The first time my parents separated, I had a very vivid memory that I've actually processed through my own therapy. Of teaching myself how to cook macaroni and cheese, because my parents were separated. My dad lived in an apartment in Knoxville. It was one of my mom's weekends. But my mom had just gotten out of one of these manic phases, and she had spent all of our money, and she hadn't paid the phone bill. So there was no phones on. And then she was drinking a lot, so she was like, kind of passed out on the couch. And I was probably like 8 years old. And I just remember walking in, and my sister was upset about whatever. She was upset about the moment, and I would get hungry, and I walked in the living room. My mom was like passed out on the couch, so I picked up the phone to call dad, but there's no dial tone. And I realized, like, oh, the phones are out, which was so normal to me at that point. So I was like, oh, okay, cool, whatever. And I just remember dragging a chair to the oven and pulling down a box of mac and cheese and being like, okay, well, I guess I'm going to try to figure this out. And I just taught myself how to cook in that moment.
Wait, so what did you call it where you almost become the parent?
The parentified child.
Oh, yeah. That's me, so, 100%.
Yeah.
Yeah. So parentified children often have to take on a role of either parent a sibling, or they parent their parents in a lot of ways. And it wasn't something that I had to do all of the time, but when I needed to turn it on, I very much turned it on.
Yeah.
And naturally, I'm a very... I have always been told, like, you're very mature for your age. You know, I was just very, just old soul, I guess you could say. I was always a responsible kid. I like to follow the rules. I don't like for people to do things they're not supposed to do. Like, I just very much, it fit, you know, it fit kind of like a glove. I was like, oh, you need me to do this thing? Sure, I'll do it. So I took on a lot of responsibility in that moment that I probably should not have had to do, but I did. And it wasn't until way, way, way later in my life, mid-20s, that I started to recognize, like, hey, this is not normal. Like, the way that you're seeing things, the way that you're engaging with people, the way you feel about others, not always normal. So all through high school and stuff, everybody called me Mama Emma. Like, that was my nickname, because I was very motherly towards people. And I'm still like that. to this day. And so part of that was just coming from that bridge five role. So, you know, we fast forward out of childhood, you know, and in a lot of ways, in most ways, I had a very normal childhood. There was this stuff going on the side, but at the same time, I was like involved in cheerleading. You know, I was always like out with my friends, like getting into shit that I shouldn't be getting into, you know, just normal kid stuff. So my mom and I, when I turned 18, I was still a senior in high school, and I was dating a guy that I had gone to high school with, who was at college, and so I would go visit him at Tech a lot. And I told her, like, yeah, I'm going to go to Tech next year, blah, blah, blah. And she really struggled with that decision of mine to move away from home. She really wanted me to go to UT. She still worked at UT. She wanted me to stay at home and go to UT. And I got accepted to UT. I applied and everything, but I just didn't want to go there. For me, it was too close to home. I didn't want to live at home anymore. I wanted to be out on my own. I'm a very independent person. When I moved out, I never moved back home, ever. And so, like, not even near the town that I grew up in. So when I graduated from high school, I was like, yeah, I'm going to go to Tech. I got my roommate lined up. I got my dorm room lined up. And it was before, like, Tech has now remodeled their dorms. They were really nice. Back then, it was literally a cinder block room.
It was like a home.
Oh, my gosh. It was so bad. But I loved it, you know. And, like, me and my roommate, we picked out, like, matching comforters. Like, we were all about it. So this was 2005. So I graduated high school. I had my last summer at home. I go on a trip to Europe, like just normal kid stuff. And I moved out in August. I went great moving day at Tech. I was so excited. My roommate and I knew each other before school. We didn't grow up together, but we had met a couple of times. And so, you know, you jump right into college. And for us, that meant like sorority recruitment, right? So we joined a sorority. She was a Phi Mu. I'm a Kappa Delta, just like Lindsay. And so I joined the sorority, and my mom was so mad at me. She was so mad at me. Really? Because she thought that sororities were terrible and that the girls that join sororities are trashy. And she's had a lot of preconceived notions about that. So she was so angry. And I just remember having these conversations with her on the phone and her just being like, so upset with me. Like, I can't believe you did this. Like, I don't understand. Like, why do you feel like you need to buy your friends? Like, she didn't get it. She didn't go to a traditional college. We had a lot of conflict there. And me being almost 19 at the time, I'm like, well, if you don't get it, then just like, too bad, right? I'm paying for it. You just get over it. So we didn't talk for a while when college started. I went home for my birthday and we kind of talked a little bit, but she was still pretty sour with me. What I didn't know at the time had been going on was that my mom, her psychiatrist had retired. So in the years leading up, 2 years before this, my mom had really leveled out. So she wasn't drinking a lot anymore. I don't think she was drinking at all, actually. She was on a new medication. She was in therapy. Like, she was doing really good. My mom also struggled with some eating disorder stuff. So at her lowest weight, she was 5'5". She was like 85 pounds. She was very little. And about the time that she died, she was at 115 pounds. So her weight had gone up. She wasn't over exercising. She was just doing really well. And you can tell a huge difference. What I didn't know had kind of coincided with me being in college and her being angry with me. I just thought it was really felt she was angry with me. But her psychiatrist had retired and she had seen a new guy who decided it would be a really good idea to take her off all of her medication.
What?
So he did So he took her off everything. And I'm not talking just psychiatric medication. I'm talking also like her hormones. My mom had had a full hysterectomy after my sister was born. So she was on estrogen and everything else. He took her off all of it. He wanted to level her out and then see what needed to happen. I didn't know that this had happened. So
at the time when you were in college at this time, had you already decided your major and like what you wanted to do?
Well, I had a major. It's not what I do now. I was an art major in college.
Okay. So that's what I was asking. Yeah. Like, had you already decided what you like that you were going to become a therapist?
No. Okay. Not even close. I was going to be like this hippie art teacher. And I went to the craft center. So Tech has the Appalachian Center for Crafts, which is like this like cool craft center. And it's like up in the woods and their dorms are cabins. And it's just as crunchy as you imagine it to be.
Okay.
Very Tennessee.
And so, yes, very Tennessee, very much so. So that's where I would spend a lot of my time. I was at the craft center, and I was going to be this art major, which was weird. I think I did it. I don't know why I did it, to be honest with you. In high school, I always was in AP honors classes, heavy into the sciences and math, and I did a complete 180, and nobody knew what was going on. And I was like, whatever. I was just 18 and just doing whatever I wanted, I guess. So, you know, right at the time I started college, my mom was really struggling with the fact that I had moved out. I wasn't there anymore. Mine and her relationship was not doing well. We weren't talking. She was angry at me, and her doctor had taken her off of all this medication, which is extremely dangerous to do that. So the day that she passed away, it was the day before Thanksgiving, my freshman year of college. So only had been about 2 months since I had moved out. That night, so my parents were still really close friends, even though they weren't married anymore. So they spent a lot of time together. And one of the things that was very important to them was that we spent all of our holidays together. So my parents had said, well, let's do our Thanksgiving Wednesday night. And then the next day I was supposed to go to South Carolina with my boyfriend at the time and his family to their like beach house that they had down there. And we would go pretty regularly. So my mom and dad had like planned this whole thing. Well, I had a drawing final that morning, so I couldn't come up early. So I was like, well, I have to go to this drawing final and then I'll leave after that. So I get up that morning, I'll do my own thing, whatever. I go to my drawing final. I'm pretty sure I failed that final because I can't draw at all to this day. I'm so bad at it. So I go, I fail this final, and I come back to my room, and I'm packing up my stuff, but I wasn't in a hurry.
And how far away was your college from where your parents lived?
An hour and 15 minutes.
Okay.
And
how old was your sister at this time?
My sister was 17, and okay. I was 19. Okay. I had just turned 19. So my sister still lived at home with my mom. She was a senior in high school. And let me tell you, like, one of the weirdest things about my decision to go to Tech, and this is related. So one of the schools I was looking at when I decided I wanted to be an art major was in Connecticut. And my dad and I had a lot of conversations about this school. And I really, really liked it. And I had applied to a bunch of schools. You know, I was like, I applied to NYU. I applied everywhere. I just wanted to get out. Right. And so my dad, I remember so vividly having a conversation with Waffle House, and he's asked me about this school. He's like, if you want it to happen, we will make it happen. And I told him I would really love to go there, but I just feel like I need to be close to home in case anything happens. And this is months before she died. And I just had such a strong feeling, like, I just need to go to somewhere close to home. I just want to be close to home in case anything were to happen. And I don't know why I have that feeling. It still freaks me out to this day. And my dad even was like, that's a really weird thing to say. And I was like, I know, but I just feel like I just want to be close to home. So Tech was an hour and 15 minutes away.
I have a question for you. Before you get into your mom's actual death and stuff, I know she had all of these issues and stuff, but did she ever... like when she was in like a depression mode or anything, did she ever throw like suicide in your face or like say that she was going to do it? Or was it literally just like never brought up before?
She was never one to be like, oh, one of these days I'm going to kill myself. You know, she wasn't ever like really verbal about it, but I always had this sense that like she felt that way. And I remember a couple of times hearing her on the phone with her friends talking about it, like overhearing her, and being young. And then, you know, when you're young and you hear stuff like that, it's so scary. And so you just kind of like act like you didn't hear it.
Yeah.
Right. You just like, oh, that's not really what's happening.
I asked because this brings up a whole different situation that we're not going to get into right now because I want to continue with your story. But I asked that because I deal with a lot of issues with my mom, kind of similar to yours, but it's a whole different ball game. But her thing is when she would get super, super drunk and stuff, she would call me and threaten that she was going to kill herself. Like almost like, what is the word I'm trying to think of? Like make me feel sorry for her.
Yeah. She's looking for you to have a reaction.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's why I was asking if your mom had ever done that or something similar.
Yeah. I think that for her, she just really wanted to like protect us from that side of her. And so this is why, like, whenever things would get really bad, we just didn't talk about it.
Yeah.
Right? Like, we just didn't talk about it at all. And my mom, she was very, like, verbal with me. She would tell me stuff and probably stuff that I didn't need to know. Like, she would, you know, all the stories about her childhood. Like, I've known those stories my whole life. I grew up knowing that, that she lived in a super abusive home. So, but when it came to her mental health and stuff, she very much protected us from that. So, like, we didn't ever know, like, was she in counseling? Was she in therapy? Was she seeing a psychiatrist? Like, I'm sure my dad did, but they didn't share that with us.
Yeah, okay. That's fair.
And I'm just going to pause for a second because my headphones are about to die. So let me switch them out really quick. Okay?
Yeah, you're fine.
Because I don't want them to die. We'll edit this part out. Okay. Are y'all there?
Yes. Okay awesome. So let's start.
Emma, I just have to say, when you were telling me that you just knew that you needed to be close to home, like, my whole body, all the way to my toes, I got goosebumps. Yeah, it's like all over.
I have that same, when I think about it, I have that same kind of reaction. I'm like, why would I ever think that? Like, that's so bizarre. But I just, I just had such a strong feeling that, I just wanted to be close to home in case anything happened.
Okay, so it was Thanksgiving Day. No, the day before Thanksgiving, and you had a final.
Yes, my drawing final that I definitely failed. I think I actually failed it. And then I think after this happened, I swear to God, I think my teacher gave me an A on it because he felt bad for me. Like, I'm visibly, because I got an A in that class and I don't know how, because I was so terrible at it. So it's that morning. I remember I'm like in my dorm room, I'm watching Oprah. And I'm like kind of packing, but not really packing. You know, I'm like kind of picking up a few things, throwing them in. I'm like texting people, which back then text was still pretty rudimentary. Like, we didn't really have Facebook yet or any of that. So just kind of talking to my friends or whatever. My roommate was already gone for the holiday. And so I was just taking my sweet time, basically. And I knew I was going to ride home with my boyfriend at the time. And he didn't want to leave until later because he was playing a video game or something. So I didn't think much of it. Well, my phone started ringing. It was my mom. And it was probably, I want to say it was around like 11:30. And so I just thought she was calling to like check in. And because I was lollygagging, I didn't answer the phone because I was like, oh man, she didn't call and ask if I'm on my way. And I'm going to tell her I'm not on my way. Right. So like, I'm just going to pack really quickly. So I didn't answer the phone. Well, then she called again. Immediately. And I was like, that's weird. And so I picked up the phone and like immediately knew something really bad had happened because my dad was on the other line. It wasn't my mom. And I couldn't even get anything out. And he was just screaming. He was just screaming. And I was like, what is, I was like, Dad, what's happening? What's going on? And he was just screaming and he was crying. And the only thing that he could say to me was, your mom shot herself. That's the only words he could get out. And I was like, what do you mean? And he just kept saying it over and over and over again. Your mom shot herself. Your mom shot herself. And I was like, so I'm like in my brain, like my trauma brain turns on and I'm immediately thinking like, oh, she accidentally shot herself, like in the foot. I remember thinking that, like, so she must have shot herself like in the foot or something and hurt herself. And I don't know why my brain went there. That's weird.
No, I get that. When I got that first phone call from my dad telling me that he thinks that my brother was dead, I was like, oh, he can't get a hold of him. Like, he can't get a hold of him. He's freaking out. He's thinking the worst case scenario. He thinks he got, like, or, like, a friend of his contacted him and said that he thought he saw Cody in a car accident or something. Like, my brain did not go to what you would think it would go to. So I completely get that. And I've had that phone call where I've heard those screams too.
Yeah. And I think that you just go and decide like a place. You can't even process like the information that's being given to you. It just does not come to you. Mm-hmm. So I don't have a clue how that phone call ended. That's all I remember about it. I don't remember leaving my dorm room, but I remember being in the hallway. And then two of my sorority sisters that lived on the third floor walked in and they saw me. And I just remember like hitting the floor and I must have been like white as a ghost. I mean, they looked at me and immediately started running because I must have looked so bad. This is like obvious something had happened. And I was on the floor, and then now I'm screaming, right? So I'm laying on the floor in the dorm, in the hallway, and I'm just yelling. And I'm just, like, so, like, scream crying, and I don't know what's happening. It was like an out-of-body experience. Like, I'm witnessing myself do this, and I don't have any control over it. So I remember they, like, picked me up, and they took me back to my room, and they got me to sit down. And they were like, what is going on? What happened? And I was, all I was able to say was what my dad had said to me. And I just said, like, my mom shot herself. And they just looked at me, and they looked at each other, and they started packing. So they were packing for you. Yeah. So they're just packing clothes. They get my phone. They call my boyfriend. They're like, you need to get here right now. Like, you need to pick her up right now. And I don't really, like, I remember this, but I don't remember a lot of it. You know, it's just very fuzzy. And so they pack all my clothes, they pack everything for me. They get my suitcase, they call my boyfriend, they walk me outside, they stand outside with me and they wait. And I remember, Alicia was one of the girls. She was a couple years older than me. She started praying. So we're all staying there and I'm just like numb at this point. I'm crying, but I'm not making any like movements or sounds or anything like that. So she just starts praying and I'm just standing there like, I don't know what to do. And so I swear in my memory, it feels like it took my boyfriend an hour to get there. And it was maybe 7 minutes. I mean, maybe at the most. But I felt like, where is he? Like, what is happening? So he finally shows up. I get in the car. And we're driving. We got pulled over twice because he was driving so fast. So I kept having to tell these cops. We had our emergency lights on and everything. And I told, had to tell two different cops being pulled over. Like, my mom shot herself. We're trying to get to the hospital. Please help us get to the hospital. And finally, the second cop that pulled us over, he escorted us as far as he could to the county line. And then we got on the interstate. And so, or we were on the interstate, something like that. So we're in the car and we're driving. And I remember, like, I remember the music we were listening to.
Are you at this point, are you at the point where, like, you're trying to find out more information?
No, I don't. Well, I don't remember calling anybody. I don't remember, like, trying to get a hold of my dad or anything like that. I just remember, I think my dad called at one point. Now that you asked that question, I think my dad called at one point and told me the ambulance had come and they were at the hospital. And that's, or somebody called me and told me that. I don't know if it was my dad.
Yeah.
So I knew to go to the hospital in Harriman. So I'm from Oliver Springs. It's like a town next to us that has the hospital. So we're in the car, we're driving. I remember he was listening to Snow Patrol. Like, I'll never forget it. We're driving in the car and I just kept, I'm an external processor. So I process things by talking about them. So I'm talking the entire way there. And I just keep telling him, I'm like, she's going to be okay. She must have just accidentally shot herself. Like, she just must have, like, you know, hurt herself in some way. Or, like, my dad, like, I'm just trying to make sense of it. And I just remember he didn't say a word. He didn't say a word at all. So we get to the hospital, and by the time we get to the hospital, I've talked myself into believing that she's fine, and, like, this was just a mistake. Like, I'm completely in shock, and my brain is not functioning anymore. So we get to the hospital, and I walk in, and I'm like, I'm here, like, told him my name, and my mom's name and stuff. They're like, come with us, and they took me back to this room, and I walk in this room, and my dad's in there, and my sister's friend, who we were very close to growing up, and everybody's just totally white, like crying white, not making any sounds. And I just walked in and I remember looking at my dad and I was like, she's dead, isn't she? And my dad was like, yes. And everybody cried but me. I just stood there. I didn't cry. I didn't make any sounds. We had to go up to the front. Eventually, you know, the doctor came in and told us, like, you know, her shot was fatal. We're so sorry. We couldn't save her. Her things have been gathered for you and you can get them at the front and we'll need you to sign some paperwork. So we go up to the front and they hand me this bag that has like little tiny baggies in it full of her things, her wedding rings, her earrings that she was wearing, had blood on them, a necklace she was wearing, like anything that was hers, we were given. And so they just hand me this bag and some paperwork to sign and then we left. And like, I just didn't cry at all. I just did nothing. I just stood there. And after that, it gets really fuzzy. I know we went to the house, but we couldn't go upstairs because it was a crime scene. Police were there. I remember the police questioning my dad because my dad was there when it happened. And so they questioned him about it. Obviously, now he's a suspect that he might have murdered her. It just got very messy very quickly. And there was no note. She left no note. She left no nothing. She literally, the story goes that my dad and her were cooking dinner. We were supposed to have Thanksgiving dinner that night. She was boiling eggs, my deviled eggs, which was my sister's favorite. And she told my dad, I'm going to get those eggs boiling. I'm going to go upstairs. That's where her bedroom and her bathroom were. Let me know when the eggs are done. And he said, okay. And she walked upstairs. About 10 minutes later, he said, he yelled up to her and he said, Connie, the eggs are done. And she said, okay. And then like seconds later, he heard a gunshot. And that was it. Just walked upstairs and shot herself. Yeah. Like no, nothing. So, you know, we have the funeral. She's cremated. We did the whole thing from there. One of the worst parts about all this for me was that because my parents were divorced, I was the next of kin. He couldn't sign any of the papers. I had to.
Yep.
So me at 19, I have to sign the death certificate. I have to sign the cremation order. I have to sign everything. So I'm trying to like deal with this and like talk about.
But you're once again the parent in the situation.
Yes, absolutely. And so I'm having to like sign all these forms and talk to all these people. My mom had a lot of outstanding debt we didn't know about. And because she killed herself, her life insurance policy only paid out 10%. So most life insurance policies have a suicide clause in them. And if the deceased kills himself, the policy doesn't pay out in full. So she had a $500,000 life insurance policy, but we only got 50,000 of that because she committed suicide. Well, when she died, we found out unknowingly that she had like $75,000 in debt. Student loan debt, credit card debt, car debt. She had taken out extra mortgages. She got an extra mortgage on the house, an extra loan on her car, like all this stuff. So now my dad's like emptying accounts trying to pay for, you know, all this debt. And
on top of funeral expenses.
Yes, on top of funeral expenses, you know, and cremated body in the state of Tennessee, like, it's not that cheap. You would think it's fairly cheap, and it's not.
No, we had a 6-hour viewing for my brother, and he was cremated, and I think it cost my dad $6,500.
Yeah, it's really crazy, you know, and it's just like, I get it, funeral directors, I understand it's a profession and stuff, but I just remember being there, and like, he's trying to upsell us on urns, and I'm like, this is disgusting. Like, I just can't even, like, you know, we're trying to pick out the cheapest one because we can't afford anything else. And he's like, but this one's really nice. And I'm like, oh, seriously, fuck you. I can't even right now. So that's, like, that was that whole. And then after that, like, I honestly don't remember a lot. I think I just was in complete shock. I remember going to my dad's house because we couldn't be at our house because of the crime scene. Obviously, you know, we had to replace carpet and drywall and things like that. My dog's like up in my face.
You're okay.
he's like, technically. There's a lot of things couldn't happen. And now it's Thanksgiving. I still have to go back to school for finals, which is really fun. So I remember going back and taking finals. And I made like a 3.8 that semester because I'm pretty sure, like I said earlier, all my teachers just gave me A's. It was pretty rough. So I go back for Christmas. I remember telling my dad, like, I just want to move home. I'm just going to drop out of school and move home. And he's like, you're not doing that, like, at all. So he moved into the house, and he saw my sister through the rest of high school. And then we, hold on, sorry. My husband's texting me. I can't talk and read at the same time. He wants me to talk about something. It just was a very messy situation is kind of what I'm getting at with all of that. And so I go back to school, and I think at that point, it's the second semester of my freshman year of college. And I tell people this all the time. Like, people have a really negative view of sorority and fraternities and stuff, but if they hadn't been for my sorority, I would not have gone back to school. And I don't think I would have ever finished because I so desperately needed that community, right? So I go back to school and I have this whole community, like all of my sorority sisters came to the funeral. And these girls did not know me. I've only been in the chapter for 2 years or 2 months, sorry. And they don't know me at all, but they're all there. They come to the funeral. They all took turns like checking on me when I got back to school. Girls that lived on the third floor, a lot of girls lived in my dorm, they would come down and walk me to classes to make sure I was going. They would like go work out with me in the gym to make sure that I was taking care of myself. They would bring me food from the cafeteria. Like that was such an outpouring for me and such a community that I so desperately needed. And I really think if it hadn't have been for that and knowing that I was going to go back to that I probably would have gone back. Cause like, I love my dad, but he wasn't the one that convinced me to not go back or to go back. Right. Like he's like, you're not going to drop out. But I was like, I can't because these people are depending on me. So yeah. I think, you know, when people talk about all the negative parts of it, there's a huge positive part. And for me, that saved so much of me. So I go back to school and I just completely, y'all, I just checked out. Like, I just focused on classes. I worked out all the time. I started hanging out with friends and I just completely blocked out that this had even happened to me. Like, straight denial. People would ask me about it and I'd be like, oh, yeah, it's fine. Like, I was so checked out from it. And it probably wasn't for probably another 2 years. Before I really started to feel the effects of that trauma that I had. So, and I think that's a really normal response for a lot of people. You know, we think of grief as like this linear process. If you move through each stage, like first you're in denial and then you're angry and then you're whatever, right? And that's just not how it works. And Candace, you kind of spoke to this when you talked about your brother, like grief is complex. And a lot of times it looks more like a roller coaster that you didn't ask to get on. And sometimes you're fully accepting that happened, and then sometimes you're back in that denial phase. Like, did this really happen to me? Like,
I know, really, I don't want you to think that we're not, like, I'm over here, like, nodding my head to everything you're saying.
Yeah, and I'm listening, like, so intently.
I wish that we weren't doing this over the phone, because it would be so much more connection. But, like, that I'm literally sitting here, everything you're, even when you were kind of explaining your mom and, like, you being a parent and, like, basically everything like that, I'm sitting over here, like, yep, get that. Understand that too.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, it's just, it's a universal experience and it's an individual experience. And it's hard to be in two places at once, right? People that have experienced grief, there's so many similarities. You know, like, yep, been there. Yep, I get that. And then there's these nuances that are just so different. But it's so important to be able to connect with other people that have shared in grief, right? To be able to say, like, I'm not alone in this.
Yeah.
So my dad pretty immediately gets us into counseling, but you know, we're from a rural place. We don't know, like, I don't know anything about counseling other than what I'd seen in TV, right? I'm like, oh, I gotta go like lay on a couch and talk to this old person. Like, I don't want to do that. So my dad, my primary care doctor, I guess back home, had got us set up with this therapist, and I don't remember anything that she told me. I don't remember anything that we talked about except for one very specific thing. She had two sons both commit suicide within a year of each other, which is horrific.
Your therapist did?
Yes.
Wow.
And that's what got her. She was a grief therapist, and she would share her story very openly. And I remember sitting across from this woman and thinking, like, if she can do this twice, I'll be okay. Like, I just very strongly remember thinking, if she can go through this twice and be standing up and functioning as a human being, then I'm going to be okay. And so, yeah, I just kind of took it and ran from there. And I ran with a mask on for a while of, like, you know, when bad things happen, you just have to, like, pick yourself up and find a positive perspective and work through it. And then I crashed really hard. And this is where it kind of gets into, like, that anxiety conversation and sober serious stuff. My crash was me, like, partying, right? I'm like, whatever. Life is short. And so
what age were you, do you think, that you finally crashed?
20, probably. So like a year and a half later.
Okay.
I never really like drank or partied in high school. Like I said, I was always like really big about following the rules and stuff. But, you know, I was in this relationship with this guy I dated in high school. he wanted to get married. I was not about that. Just wasn't what I wanted. And that wasn't great. That was just me. I just didn't want to get married at that stage in my life. But I just wasn't into it. We were on different paths. And so we get near to breaking up, and I just like threw myself into the social life. So I start going to these parties, and I start like experimenting with alcohol for the first time, drinking, and just like, I was having a good time. Don't get me wrong. Like, it was fun. I wouldn't take it back now. Even knowing everything that I know, but I also recognize that now is like, that was my crash. Like, I could no longer live in this like fake universe of like, oh, bad things happen. Just find a positive perspective and pick yourself up. And it never helps that when I would say that to people, they'd be like, wow, you're so inspiring. That's so awesome. You know, because they believed that I was not bullshitting them, but I was bullshitting them and myself. And
yeah. And they also haven't been through the situation. So they don't know firsthand of the steps and things that you go through.
And you have to understand everyone was so young that probably even if they did have any sort of understanding, they don't know what to say or how to handle.
No, absolutely not.
This experience for you.
Sure. We were all kids, you know?
Yeah.
And so nobody was able to look at me and be like, hey, you're like deep into avoidance. You know that, right? And so I was just like living my life, avoiding, like trying to get a six pack and spring break body and just not engaging. I didn't hardly go home. Just didn't want to have anything to do with it, honestly. And so I started drinking in college, and you know, I've always been a really anxious person. Even when I was little, I would have panic attacks in the fourth grade. I remember my parents had to have a parent teacher conference because I would cry every time my teacher would talk to me. He was this huge guy. He was probably 6 foot tall, and he was like a football coach. And like, he scared me, you know, I was such an anxious kid. I was so afraid that I would get the answers wrong, that I wouldn't be able to answer. And then I would just cry, and I was having panic attacks, but they just thought I was weird. And, nobody recognized that this was what was happening. None of my teachers saw that I was anxious. None of my coaches, when I did dance or cheer. I mean, I would have full blown panic attacks before any competition, and my coach would just yell at me. She'd be like, I don't know why you always act like this. Like, you're ruining everything for the team. I'm like, I don't know. Like, I feel like I'm dying. Somebody help me.
Yeah.
So I was having panic attacks from a young age. Probably had a lot too, from going on at home, everything else, all intertwined. So I guess I was about 20 when I started this crash process, right? Of like, now I'm drinking and I'm going to all these parties. Well, I also started having these massive panic attacks, but mine would come in my sleep. So I remember one night I woke up and I legit thought I was having a heart attack. I wasn't emotional at all, but my left arm hurt. It hurt in my throat. I couldn't breathe. And I got in the car and I drove myself to the emergency room. And this happened multiple times.
How old were you when this happened?
I was 21.
Okay. I had my first panic attack when I was like 17, and I went to the ER because I thought I was dying.
You really do feel like you are having an actual heart attack. So I get to the emergency room and I'm like, oh my God, like I'm dying. Like, I'm having a heart attack. I'm 20 years old. I'm having a heart attack. And they take me back and they're like, you're fine. Like, you are having a panic attack. And I'm like, what? This is crazy. Like, I'm dying. You guys don't understand. And they're like, no, you're not dying. You are just really stressed. So they write it off as like, yeah, you're just stressed from school and, you know, maybe you've been drinking too much alcohol. And I'm like, okay, probably. So this just kept happening.
Yeah.
Panic attacks, and yeah, it just led to like a year of this cycle, right? Like drink and avoid and panic and anxiety, and then drink because you're anxious, and I would never say, like, even now being sober curious, which I know you guys want to talk about and we are getting there. I know I've been talking forever. But you know, I never really understood that it was such a typical process, and I would not ever categorize myself as having had a problem with alcohol in the first place. I was never an addict. It was never something I had to have. It was definitely a negative coping skill that was so normalized in my environment that I never would have thought of it that way.
Yeah.
Right. This is just what fun people do. And I'm sure Lindsay can attest to this, like knowing me at that time in my life, like I was always at the fraternity house. Like, I was always down to party. I was always the fun girl, like, always brought a deck of cards, always waiting to, you know, drinking games. Like, that was who I was. Like, that's what I did. And it was everybody else was doing it. So I never, ever, ever considered like that this is a problem for me.
No, and I have to say something there. And when I was explaining you to Candace, I was talking about your sober curious. Was like
basically the same exact
thing. Yeah, I said basically the exact same thing. I was like, she's by no means an alcoholic. She's not dependent on it. But Emma was always, and you're such a, in my eyes, a very calm, level-headed human. And so I would never have associated you drinking with anxiety. I always would have associated it with that you just could drink and handle it. And through your journey and following you through this has opened, I don't know, for me, a lot into like learning more about you. But through learning more about you, I've learned a lot about how I can see in other people or even in myself how other people are dependent on it, because you're so calm. And when you would be out at a party or we'd be out to dinner or whatever, you'd have a drink and or we'd have a game or whatever. And it was just so calm. I never would have associated it with your anxiety until you started this journey. Does that make
sense? Yeah, you know, and I've heard that from other people too. Like when I tell people that I have anxiety, they're like, what? Like, no, you don't. Because I'm a pretty level, like, person most of the time. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty chill about most things. I'm very, like, open. Like, I don't really care. Like, you do you, right? Like, I'm cool with whatever. And I always had friends that were from all different types of, like, lifestyles and different walks and just very, like, I'm extremely extroverted. My emotional battery is very much charged by being with other people. So I was always out. I never was like somebody that you would see and think that person has anxiety, which is probably why I was not officially diagnosed with anxiety until 2011.
Wow.
I went that far into my life before anybody sat me down and was like, you have generalized anxiety disorder. That's what this is, right? Because I don't present that way. And when people hear that, they're like, that doesn't make any sense. Like, you're so calm. And I'm like, yeah, but inside, like, trust me. I'm freaking the fuck out all of the time. My brain is always, always, always criticizing and like stuck. I'm like, I can't believe you said that. Like, you're such an idiot. Like, nobody likes you. You know, just like these constant negative thoughts. I always this feeling of like, there's a little anxiety. Feels like you're stuck in a room and there's no door and there's a computer and it's on and there's a radio and you have earbuds in and there's a TV and a projector and they're all on. And they're flashing these lights and it's constant noise and somebody's asked you to focus on just one of them. And that's what it feels like all the time when you have anxiety. And so when I drank, that all went away, you know, like that all just turned off. And there wasn't the computer and the TV and the radio and the music anymore. It was just me hanging out with my friends. And then you couple that with a culture where like, that's what we did. That's what was fun. And so it just fit so perfectly. So I never even thought it was an issue. For me, it was like, yeah, this thing makes me feel better. I don't worry about stuff when I'm drinking. And everybody else is doing it and it makes me fun and people want to be around me, which I very much believe that people didn't want to be around me and that nobody liked me. Right. And so this, it was just such a cyclical process that it was like, how do you get out of that? Right. Like, how do you break through that cycle? So I just went on with that for a long time. After college, I moved to Nashville. I worked at Vanderbilt Medical. I had an art degree. I worked in cancer research. I've had a very weird path. I worked in cancer research for like 2.5 years. GI cancer research, I worked with the patient population. I ended up working my way up in the lab. I don't know anything about this stuff, but I can be very charismatic and my boss likes me and I catch on to things quick. So eventually, before I know it, I'm like her direct assistant. I'm traveling. I presented on like tissue repositories. This is what we did, which, like, if you don't know what that is, don't even worry about it because I'm foreign. But I like presented on tissue repositories in southern France and like worked in Spain for a while. Like, just weird. It was a weird time in my life. But that job was so demanding. And that's when I was diagnosed with anxiety because I was like having a panic attack every day and my boss was extremely demanding. And so I'm working with these patients. It's extremely heavy work. I'm just needed to be on call all the time. I had to be at work at 5:45 in the morning, like ready to go into pre-op.
Oh my God.
To meet my patients. Yeah. And so I'm working like crazy hours. I'm going to bed at like 7 o'clock at night or I'm staying up until 3 o'clock in the morning drinking. sleeping for an hour and a half and then going to work, right? It's not sustainable.
No.
You can't do that for long. Yeah. So finally I get diagnosed with anxiety and I'm like, okay, this answers everything, right? Like, now I have my answer. This is my problem. So I had already started graduate school this time for counseling. I was at Lipscomb. I dropped out of school. I quit my job. I got a graduate assistantship at Tech and I moved back to Cookeville. Like in the matter of like 2 weeks, this was my answer. I was going to fix everything. So I moved back to Cookeville. I started this graduate program in counseling and I'm like, well, if I can learn about counseling, then I can like fix myself, right? And then I can go fix other people. Like, I'm an idiot across the board. Like, that's not how this works. So that's kind of how I ended up in graduate school. People ask me all the time, like, how did you decide to be a counselor? And I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. It just happened organically, I think, in a lot of ways. I always was interested in it after my mom died. I became more interested in it because I had a lot of interactions in counseling. Like, I had gone to counseling a couple of times. It was never something I'd step with. I would go for like 2 or 3 sessions, then I would feel better, and then I would quit. And that was that avoidance, right? Like, yeah. Oh, I'm good. Thanks. I'm all better. Thanks. I talked about it. And so I think just over the years, I knew I didn't want to teach. I definitely didn't want to stay in cancer research. I didn't want to stay at Vanderbilt. And so it just was like the next thing, like, well, I'll kind of try this. Like, this is interesting to me and I'll try it. And it stuck, you know, and I'm actually thinking pretty good at it. So that's just nice. But yeah, that's kind of how I ended up at that point. And then, you know, graduate school and counseling and all that stuff. And now here I am on the other side, somewhat being very vulnerable and sort of serious all at the same time.
So you live in Tennessee now. Still.
You're still in Cookeville, right?
Yeah.
Still
in Cookeville. My husband and I bought a house.
What do you say?
It is. We love it.
It's a really pretty house.
It is.
Yeah. I'll show you pictures.
Okay.
Not that I've ever been there, but she's posted pictures.
So you're happily married now.
Oh, yeah.
I think my final question for you now is, how do you want children?
Oh, gosh. Going right to the deep end. So that's
like one day.
That's actually a conversation that's happening a lot in our house right now. Because, you know, I'm going to be 34. All of our friends are having kids. Like, all of them are having kids at once. And so it's definitely something that...
You have a new niece, right?
A nephew. Nephew. Yes, he was just born on
Saturday. So your sister had a baby.
No, actually my brother-in-law.
Okay. Okay. Okay.
I already have a nephew. He's, I hope he's not listening to this. He'll be 12 this year.
So my sister
had a baby when she was 19.
Wow. So right after your mom passed away, she had a baby basically.
Yes. Like 2 years later. Yeah. She had a baby.
Wow.
And so he's 12 now and his name's Oliver and he's a really super cool kid and he thinks that I'm super cool and he calls me, well, when he was little he called me Aunt Mema because he couldn't say Emma, so it was really cute.
So okay, well that I can kind of ask my follow-up question, my like actual question, and you can kind of give me your thoughts on it. So you have a nephew, his mom went through the same thing that you did. Is she open with him about it?
Yes. So this is where things get more complicated.
That's what I was gonna ask you. If my main thing is, when you have children, if you decide to have children, how do you think this would affect your parenting, and if you would be open to them about this? Because like, suicide is kind of a taboo thing and it's a serious thing, and like,
yeah,
they're gonna grow up without that, like that grandma. And so how do you navigate that?
Oh, before you answer that, Emma, I have, so my grandmother's brother committed suicide when my dad and his cousin were very young.
Mm-hmm.
And he was there. Everyone was at the house the day that it happened. So they only had one daughter. So that's my cousin. And then I grew up knowing about it. I grew up from my earliest memories, knowing about my Uncle Junebug, who passed away because he shot himself because he was very sad. I mean, from the time I was little, I've always known about that. Mm-hmm. So suicide has always been a conversation in my family.
Yeah.
And he's never been a forgotten member of the family. So from my perspective, even though I'm very much removed, I never, ever knew him. I think it was important because now he's, like, his history still lives on through us.
Yeah, through you.
But now you answer for you, Emma.
Well, yeah, and I think that that's really important when kids come into the picture. So, like, I know that my nephew knows, like, he knows about his grandmother, and he knows that she died before he was born. I don't know the extent as to what those conversations have been like. And part of that is because of mine and my sister's relationship and kind of the state that it's in, and we don't really communicate. Mm-hmm. And that's like a whole nother thing. Very hard. And so I think when it comes to, like, to my future potential children, I very much want them to understand. I think we shelter children from things so much, but kids are extremely intuitive and they pick up on stuff. And it's not something, I'm not ashamed that this happened to me. And I think that when we make things taboo and we keep them in the shadows, that it doesn't help people understand. Like, because we're all going to get sad and we're all going to experience depression on some level. And, you know, the thing that my husband had texted earlier, I think plays into this a lot. He had texted me and he said, I mean, you should talk about the concept that people play this out in their heads as an ideation and they get so close they slip over the edge and make irreversible decisions sometimes. And it's always stuck with me as a warning not to play that game. You know, one of the main theories that I run with now about my mom's death is that my mom, and this is very common, that people will act out a suicidal ideation or a suicidal thought as a way of coping. So they might, if they plan to kill themselves by shooting themselves, they might put the gun in their mouth and then play that out. And that helps them feel better. But sometimes accidents happen. Mm-hmm. Right. And so sometimes people do that and then they make this irreversible decision, or in the moment that impulse happens and they go for it. And I would want my children to understand that it's okay to feel sad and it's okay to be depressed sometimes. But that what we don't do is we don't get so far down that path that we do what grandma did, right? That we don't remove ourselves. We don't play that game, as my husband said. So I think when it comes to my kids, like my future theoretical children that don't exist yet, I absolutely want to be open with them in an age-appropriate way about the fact that I know you have a grandma and a grandpa, and, you know, you have your grandpa, my dad, but you don't have a grandma, and why don't you have a grandma, and why do all their kids have a grandma, and where is she, and what happened to her? Those are absolutely questions that are going to come up, and I think, like you said, Lindsay, you know, one of the ways that we keep those people alive for us is we talk about them. Yeah. And we share them with people, and that memory, that energy is very important. And so I would want my kids to understand the dynamics of it from multiple perspectives. One, this is their grandmother that they're never going to get the chance to meet, which really sucks because she would have been a killer grandma. Like, she would have been the best at it, right? So they're really missing out in that. And I would also want my kids to know from a young age that, like, feelings are okay. Like, your feelings are okay. I tell people this at work all of the time. This is a huge component of counseling when I work with people. It's like, we have to normalize feelings. Like, being angry is not a problem. But if every time I'm angry, I punch you in the face, that's the problem.
It's the action.
It's not the feeling. It's the action on the
feeling.
It's
the behavior.
Yeah.
Right? And so I would want my children to understand from a young age, like, your feelings are fine, but you have to be in control of your behavior. Your feelings can't dictate your behavior. And I think that when we talk about suicide, that's a huge component of that. Like, people have to understand, like, it's okay to be sad, but this is not the answer. And so I would never want it to be something that my children felt like was taboo, or like, yeah, I know grandma died, but, like, mom doesn't talk about it, or we don't ask mom about grandma, right? I would want them to very much feel comfortable coming to me and saying, like, can you tell me what happened again? And what was she like? And asking me those questions. I don't want to normalize suicide, but I do want to normalize that those emotions exist. Yep. Give them the tools to work through that as they're adults, right? Because I've experienced depression. I don't think there's a person alive that hasn't.
No. Nope. I agree with you. Well, I want to thank you for sharing your story and for coming on to our podcast and opening up and being so vulnerable. I know it's not easy. I literally just did it last week, so I totally understand what all the emotions and stuff that I can bring up and just energy to tell your story and everything. But Lindsay, do you have any closing?
Yeah, I do. I do want to say this because I feel the need sometimes to be validated that every single interaction I've ever had with you has been amazing. I don't want to say amazing, but it's been good that I know sometimes you think back and you're like, what did I say? And did that person like me? And I bet they hate me. And for me, I'm crying myself to sleep over all the things I've said and people hate me. That's like how I sleep at night. It's not healthy. But I just want you to know that.
Exhaust yourself with tears.
Yes, you exhaust yourself with tears and you sleep good. It's not healthy.
Lindsay, that is not healthy.
No, it's not. But it is sometimes where you're at in your life. But I just need you to know that for me, at least, that like you've always been such a person for me to look up to and a person for me to like, I don't know. You've always been so open and honest and comforting, even.
Why didn't we talk about Emma for your inspirational women?
I don't know, because I was thinking like famous. We did famous inspirational women.
I know. I was just kidding.
But it was. I don't know. I just
another episode and just talk about how inspirational I've been to you.
Yeah, all about it.
You don't listen to
it. I just need you to know that for at least me, I can't speak for anyone else. But for at least me, you've always been very awesome to have around and just a voice of like just sheer reason, because I've dealt with anxiety since I was very little. And I mean, I knew you dealt with anxiety too. I know that we've talked about it, but you just, I don't know, you helped me in times in college whenever I literally was like crying every day, all day long.
Yeah. Well, I'm really glad to hear that. And I think a lot of times those thoughts that we have about ourselves, like they're just rooted in so much nonsense.
Yeah.
And we just don't understand that you don't have to believe every thought your brain tells you.
Yes. Right? You can lie to yourself.
Like, yeah, just like check it, you know, like check in with that and understand that your brain is just throwing stuff out there and you don't have to believe all of it is truth. And that's a really hard process to get to. And I know we didn't, I feel like I've just talked y'all's ear off. And
no, you're not.
It's just a long story, but I know we didn't really get into like, if they were curious
about, that's okay, you know what, like if that. You are open to it, well, I would love to have you back on for we can get into that.
We could talk about it deeper and like what it truly means. I keep for trying to get my husband to try it.
And I, you know, I would just say, like, as a blanket statement, if you are hesitant to stop drinking for 30 days, you need to stop drinking for 30 days. Period. If you are the person that's like, everybody's doing dry January, but like, I don't really want to, if there's hesitation about removing something from your life, then you need to remove it. And you need to see why and where that's coming from in you, that you're saying like, I just can't. Well, why not? Like, why
that's a really solid advice. And I just thought about it. And you know, I was just like, you know, could I go 30 days without drinking? And absolutely I could, because I don't think I drank one thing in January. The last time I had a drink on like Christmas or something. And then the next time was when we went out for dinner Saturday.
Those are the last two times I've drank too.
Yeah.
I've actually poured myself a glass of wine with a friend at my house.
And then not drank
and
it.
And I didn't touch it. I poured it out. Yeah. I didn't even sip it. I don't know. I deal with hydration things and alcohol makes me dehydrated.
Yeah. So. Same.
Yeah. Well, you and everybody else on the planet too, right? And
yeah. So, well, Emma,
yours is exacerbated for sure. But.
Emma, I'm going to close out the podcast. After we are done, it's going to hang up on you, just so you know. You don't have to say anything else. You can probably hang up now. I don't know what would happen, but I'm just letting you know that I'm going to close it out.
Yeah. And thank you so much for doing this. This means a lot to me.
Yeah, this was awesome.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, anytime you guys want me to come back on and talk about whatever else, I know I think like 9 topics, Lindsay. So
I know.
Totally cool to do it again. And you know, not be so like just me talking, but maybe a more like back and forth engaging interview.
For sure.
Totally down. So just let me know.
Great. Thank you so much. And thank you guys so much for listening to our Lady Parts podcast. You can find us on ourladyparts.com or follow us on Instagram at ourladypartspodcast. We want to thank you guys for listening. I know these have been some heavy podcasts lately, but they are necessary podcasts. And we are super excited that you guys get to hear everybody else's stories and not just ours. I suck saying the word ours. Sorry about that.
That's okay. I'm not judging you.
I know. You never judge me. She does actually judge me, but
all the time.
Yeah. Thank you guys so much for listening, and we will see you guys next week. Bye.